The next panel is going to be actually a good segue to the last thing we talked about. And it's going to be on getting involved in your specialty. So we're fortunate to have Dr. Gino Romero, who's the chairman at Rush, Dr. Brad Bunning, who is the program director at U of I, and Dr. Rebecca Parker, who's the executive vice president of the North Division of EM Care. So we'll let them kind of give their initial statements and then, as before, open up to questions in the audience.
Fantastic. Thanks, Matthew. Well, thanks to you that all decided to stay and join us for this section. We're going to speak to you today about organized medicine and try to share with you what has been of value to us. As way of background, I'm Becky Parker. I work with MCARE, the Chicago office. My other role that brings me to this table is I'm on the board of directors in the American College of Emergency Physicians. So with my colleague, Mark Mackey, so I'm just going to say Mackey, Mark and I represent you to the National Board of Directors. So what I thought I'd do is tell you a little bit about my personal story, because I've been one of those people that's tried a variety of practice environments and have really found, for me, ASEP and organized medicine to help me figure this, you know, my career path out, and sometimes my personal life out as well. So I actually went to Northwestern for medical school, and then I trained in Texas. And served on academic faculty for a couple of years, liked teaching, but really liked to run a room. And so went back into private practice, seeing that I had an interest in the business of medicine. And I'll actually take the opposite stance that Bill was talking about rural practice and community practice. I think we're actually really trained to be in that environment. So my argument's always, you don't need me at Northwestern, because I can just call a cardiologist who's going to come right down. You need me in Springer, Illinois, going, we got to get this guy out of here because we don't have the resources to get this done. So, and I really enjoyed that part of community practice, of being able to run that room, do the intubations, and make some of those decisions and help people at that grassroots level. So kind of just a little plug on the side for kind of community rural practice. But then had an opportunity to then practice in as an attending with a small group, a single contract holder group. I had a chance to be in a Democratic group where I started as a partnership, as a part of a four-person partnership, to then working out for a corporate group. So I've seen the myriad of all kinds of groups and settled into where I am right now, but I have that perspective. And really, ASEP has been along with me the entire way. So I started being really involved in organized medicine as a resident, actually. I was elected second run to the EMRA Board of Directors. And how many EMRA members are here right now? Are you all EMRA members? I hope so. So I was a resident board member. I edited EM Residents, which you guys get, and also redid their website after I volunteered, where I said, geez, the website needs updating. The president at the time, Cherry Hopkins, went, and you're the one to do it. I was like, darn it. So, that type of opportunities helped me grow as a professional to go to learn a lot about how do you write a website, but also how to be a leader. I then moved on and did become involved in my state chapter. At the time it was Texas. Got on committees, got involved there, got elected to the board of directors there, actually created their website because I used that to get on the board of directors, and ended up moving back to Illinois and got early got involved with the education committee and also then became on the board of directors there. And on the national side, started getting involved in committee work and really found kind of practice management as my passion. So talking about finding your passion, I completely agree. It was very lonely kind of getting out and thinking, geez, isn't there more here? And so for me, ASEP and organized medicine was a way for me to find what I found of interest and what was my passion. And so went into coding and billing and reimbursement and then to EM practice and practice management. And my path really followed through organized medicine. And I found my mentors and the knowledge that I needed to help me figure out what was the best position for me. Ironically, right now, my job is a lot of teaching. So I do a lot of leadership development and teaching along with some practice management. So I've kind of come back full circle to doing a type of academics that's not the traditional academics, but kind of in a more of a practice management environment. What are the benefits I have found from organized medicine? I'm going to talk to you about what national ASEP, what I think the benefits are, and then Brad's going to talk about academics and academic organizations, and Dino's going to focus in on the state level as well. But there's a couple of things. One is information. So I'll give you a few hints to supplement what Matthew said. EMRA has some great resources. If you guys are making this transition, if you go to ASEP 13, they have a life after residency program that's excellent. It talks about all the things that Matthew was saying you should think about. Go to their website. Lots of resources. They have a great, and I think Bill will agree, a great book written by Joe Wood about contracts and contract negotiation. That's cheap, very, very brief, and really is a great resource. So that I found a lot of resources at the national level. When you come out, the Section of Young Physicians will invite you as an ASEP new member to join them. They give you a year of free membership, and that's a great way to kind of find your home within the college, which is the way that I found my home, is by, you know, checking out these different sections and state chapter events, etc. And then, of course, as you get out, and if you're non-academic, that's where you're going to get your continuing education. That's where you're going to get your information to keep you up to date, keep you current, along with any policies. So we do a lot of standardization of policies. So if you're having a drug-seeking issue in your department, you can turn to ASEP and say, boy, what does the college have on this topic so that I can use this with my director to affect change in my own department? So lots of information resources. For the professional development side, I met some really amazing people, two of whom are sitting next to me, by the way. So content experts, experts within our specialty, I got to see some great leaders lead and watch them run committee meetings and how they corralled volunteer physicians to get things accomplished. And I really learned a lot from those folks. And then we had a chance to network and become friends with them. And then you have this cadre of people you can just turn to and go, hey, Brad, I need to teach PAs how to do this. How would you do that? And so that over the 15 years I've been doing this, that's been a huge piece of the puzzle for me personally. That's been a huge benefit. From an advocacy standpoint, ASEP is your advocacy organization. We look at emergency medicine. We have a DC office. So that's the place that we go to advocate on Capitol Hill or at the state level, bring resources back to the state, but you know, speak to that about reimbursement issues, about, you know, how are we gonna get paid in the future with these quality measures, which you guys may start hearing about. ASEP can go out there and kind of advocate for what's best for us and for you personally, as well as for your patients, which is really our bottom line. So that advocacy piece can be a lot of fun also. If any of you want a kind of an interesting conference to go to, I suggest going to ASEP Spring Conference, Leadership and Advocacy Conference in DC. It's essentially free, I think it's like $100 to go. And it's a 3-day conference on leadership and advocacy. And it we do go to the Capitol Hill and do advocate for any type of bill that we're working on at that time. And you meet some great people. It's a smaller conference. There's a lot of passion in the room, and you can find kind of what's your interest and what's your need. So in the end, what I would say about organized medicine is, you know, find your home, pick a society, belong to a society, whether it's ASEP, whether it's SAM, whether it's AMA, wherever you are comfortable and it matches your values, you know, join one of them. You'll get back much more than you'll give. That's always been my experience, even with all the times that I volunteered, I've gotten a lot more back for myself. Get involved at the state level. We have sections. All of these organizations have kind of grassroots way to get involved, so definitely look into that. And use your organized medicine as a place to find your home, a place to find your passion for the next 10, 20, 30 years of your career. This can really be the place where you find your home in the end.
Thanks, buddy.
My name's Dio Lamora. No, I was. It's a grocery list I'm doing. Dino Romero, currently chairman at Rush, past president of ISA, currently on the board of directors, and you know, the whole topic getting involved in your specialty is such an important topic, and a lot of it was covered by the previous panel here. So it was interesting sitting back listening. We all share the same experiences. You know, when you first get out of residency, everything they said is true. Right now, when you graduate, you are the smartest you are going to be in this specialty. As scary as that may sound, that's absolutely true. You're at the best point in your career right now. You have friends, you have camaraderie, and you'll migrate to whatever your practice is, you'll migrate towards your comfort zone, whether it's clinical, rural, or urban, whatever it may be. Some of you will be education, others not. You do hit that November wall. I remember the day I was driving into work when I hit that wall. And I called my wife, cell phones I think were new back then, so I had this big bag phone. And I called my wife, I said, you know, I'm driving in thinking I'm driving in for another shift. I trained all these years and this is what I do. I said, I think I've seen everything already at this point, which is a dangerous thing to say. But you really just kind of hit that where you really are questioning, is this why I went to all this training and now is this what I want to do? And it was at that point I started being a little more introspective. So literally 4 to 6 months out of residency, I started thinking about, okay, what am I going to do now? That's why it's so important to get involved and important to know what you can get involved with. You have a lot of resources. If you stay here in Illinois, you have a lot of resources. If you go outside of Illinois, most states have the same resources. So here's a couple things. Your state chapter, ICEP, is a great way to get involved. It allows you to rebuild some of those relationships you lose after residency. You know the best thing I like about coming to these meetings? I love sitting on panels and talking at that. But really what I love is when I'm out there talking with these guys saying, you know what's killing me right now? I have this one sickle cell patient I can't get out of the ER, and I don't know what else to do with him. And all of a sudden everybody has 10 ideas and says, I know that guy. Or here's what we've done. You know, it's building those relationships again. And you really have to make an effort to do it. It's not gonna come to you, you have to go to it. And ICEP is a way to do that. In ICEP, you have a number of committees you can get involved with. I tell you my mistake. I said, I'm going to get involved with ICEP. I joined the Government Affairs Committee at a time where Sue Nedza was head of Government Affairs Committee. If you don't know Sue Nedza, she's legendary. She is a go-getter. She lived in Springfield. She really pushed a lot of legislation on behalf of emergency medicine. So I had a lot of passion I have to follow in her footsteps. I couldn't keep up. I didn't know anything. I didn't know what I was talking about. So that was like a failed attempt. So my point is, you want to pick something you're comfortable in that you can be successful at. I regrouped and I got on the research committee. I think you were on the research committee. You were chair of the research committee. And that was a much more comfortable group to work with. And I started to make the relationships and learn what I needed to learn about other committees to get involved with. From there, I went to education committee, went to the written board committee, ended up chairing that committee. And again, you're networking the whole time. Networking in the business world is essential to grow a business practice. We don't talk about it in medicine very much, but that's what you need to do. You need to network. You need to open up doors. And the doors will open for you. Again, the whole idea about saying yes, don't be afraid to say yes. Just be aware of what you're saying yes to and what it means. Don't expect payment up front for things when you say yes. There were a lot of comments about say yes for the right reasons. Don't counter with, well, what are you going to pay me for that? I get that a lot. I get a, you know, yeah, I'll be happy to do it, but what are you going to pay? The idea is what you're trying to do is position yourself, put yourself in a position where when an opportunity opens up that does have money tied to it or on clinical time, you're the person people are going to and it's being offered to you. There's a lot of great examples, not just at our institution, but across the city where this has happened. And then locally at the hospital as well. There's so much you can do in your hospital. As an emergency physician, you're trained, you're a process excellent. You're a process improvement expert. Thank you. You may not be a speaking expert, but you'd be a process improvement expert. And you know, so the administration looks to you for a lot of things that other specialties won't even want to come near. So when your chairman of your department says we have a joint commission survey coming up, a lot of you may not even know what that means other than it's a group that watches over your shoulder. Volunteer to be part of that. Start learning about things, learn about credentialing, learn about things that other people don't want to touch. And you'll find you're actually very good at it. The things on the horizon, all the rules and regulations that go along with Joint Commission and CMS, that's always an open door if anybody wants to do stuff along those lanes. Quality and safety, and now there's a link between quality and safety and not just patient outcomes, but tying it back to education and how do you train residents and students in quality and safety. Patient satisfaction, outcomes, we're getting paid for that, our pay is based on that. There's public reporting on this, it's very important, and they're looking for people to fill those niches. So get involved in it, don't be afraid to say yes. Get involved at the local level and at the hospital level.
Okay, my name is Brad Bunny. I'm the program director at UIC. I want to echo not only what both of my co-panelists have said, but also what I heard in the prior panel section. when I'm counseling medical students about going into emergency medicine, it's interesting, and a number of the residents have probably heard this one from me before, but there's that aha moment of, I'm going to be an emergency physician, or I'm going to be a general surgeon, or I'm going to go into family medicine, and then you're done. You've made the last big decision that you have to make for your career. And that's wrong. You're going to be making decisions throughout your career. When you've decided that you're going to go into emergency medicine, you just joined either your first or your second marriage. You now have a 30-year commitment to your career. And so the question that I pose to you is, what are you going to do to make that career worthwhile, to make that marriage interesting? And we talk a lot about niches and things like that. There are a whole variety of niches within emergency medicine. Academics is one of them. There are a lot of opportunities out there, both on the research side, which I can speak to, or on the education side, or anything in between. Even within academics, with the whole changes that everybody knows as coming down the pike from the ACGME and that wonderful things that we call milestones, there's a lot of different pieces to that that include patient safety pieces, quality improvement pieces that Dina was talking about, that are all going to need people to participate in to implement them. There are a number of great organizations nationally, CORD, the Council of Residency Directors, SAEM, all have sections that are looking at milestones, that are looking at quality improvement, that are looking at the educational piece. So there's a lot of different places that people need to fill in, and we're expecting you, as the next generation, to step up and to help fill in. The group of residents that you're currently training with is probably going to be some of your closest friends throughout your career. It's a fabulous network. Dino and I train together. We've known each other for years. It's one of those things where you have other people that you can rely on, that you can bounce things off of. Coming to these meetings, like Dino said, is great. I don't get to see Ed Ward and listen to his comments unless I come to some of these meetings. And so it's invaluable to continue to participate in these things in order to keep yourself in touch. One of the other things that I really want to encourage everybody to do, and we don't necessarily talk about it enough, but that's mentorship. And the absolute importance in finding the right mentor. Not the one that's going to kick your butt, and not the one that's going to let you slide, but the one that's going to help you grow. And so when you finally have had your second aha moment of what your niche is going to be within emergency medicine, whether it's ultrasound or toxicology or quality improvement or education, your next job is to find that mentor that's going to help you grow. And it's going to get you from level A to level B and then on up. That is probably the single most important next decision that you make. Doing things on a volunteer basis, I've done more things on a volunteer basis than I can possibly imagine, but it means that I've also been able to grow my CV, it means that I've been able to grow my career, it means that I've been able to stay in an academic institution and get promoted and get tenured and things like that. When it finally comes time for you as seniors to start thinking about, where am I going to go to work first, what am I going to do, and the balance between what does my family need, what do I want career-wise, what is my current financial situation, good, bad, or indifferent, make sure that you're balancing that with what you want professionally, with what you're going to want to have as a career going forward, so that you can start channeling yourself into that niche. Now, a lot of people like to go out in their first few years and go make a ton of money and get rid of their debt. That's okay if that's what you like to do. But realize that most of your loans are scheduled for 20 or even 30 years, and there's a reason for that, so that you can pay them off comfortably. It's nice to be able to have the ability to have a good credit score, which you get from being able to pay off on a timely basis your debts. So don't necessarily rush into the fact that you need to clear out all your debt immediately. Look for what's going to actually be your comfort zone and where you want to be. As a side note, I've been at UIC now for 20 years, but I've also been moonlighting for 22 years. So I have always gone out into the community just to be able to have that aspect of it. So I can't tell you the last time that Jen allowed me to intubate at UIC. Never. I haven't intubated there in a long, long time. But I'm out at a 4-bed emergency department in Belvedere, Illinois, where I've got nothing over my head and I'm the only doc. I intubated last month. And so making sure that you have some type of balance that keeps you in your comfort zone, but allows you to develop the type of career that you're gonna want is the key going forward.
Any audience questions? So this was my stock question seeing this panel. I've been warned over and over as a young faculty member about overcommitment. And some members of my class who even went into community medicine, which doesn't typically have that reputation of causing overcommitment, have already experienced this a little bit. Can you kind of speak to that, the level to which you think is an actual problem, and possible strategies to avoid it?
Okay. Sure. I'm overcommitted right now. It's something that's very real, and it's hard to figure out when to dial back and how to dial back. I think, it's a good news, bad news story. When you say yes to something, if you're able to get it done and you do it well, you're going to be asked a few other times to do some more things, and at some point you do have to start saying no and to write, there about every 5 years or so, you need to be very introspective about what you're doing and reevaluate and readjust from there. And that's your time to say no to some people, turn some things down, and readjust. But I'll tell you, you have to be careful. Here's my careful story. When I started my new job at Rush, this is about 12 years ago now, things were very busy. We're building a new ER and whatnot. And I had a lot on my plate. I was overcommitted. And I received a phone call, and my secretary says, "You want to take this phone call? Some guy wants to know if you want to partner with him on something business-wise." And I said, "Sure, I'll take it." He says, "We're starting something. It's called MD Consult. We want to know if the Rush physicians would like to be the doctors behind MD Consult." And I said, "Come on." I said, "You know what? I don't have time for this." You do say no at times, and you probably shouldn't say no. But it's the risk you take. Otherwise, you do get even more overcommitted.
I would say it's a balancing act, definitely. And I would definitely involve my family in anything that comes up. And there's a little running joke with my husband and I came home and I was excited about a new project or a new position I just got elected to. And he turned to me and said, "What are we doing now?" So, which is very telling. So whatever I'm doing, I make sure to touch base with him, and I've been lucky to have a partner who finds these things interesting along with me and is completely supportive for me to be able to do these things. Without him, I couldn't do it, and we do have two small children as well. I think there's a generational piece here too, just to be aware of. There's some great generational talks about things, but we really have a mix of kind of baby boomers with Xers, with millennials, and I think the boomers are a little more about going to meetings and doing a lot of things and really be heavily involved. And I think that at least my generation from X is, and even the one coming up, you guys right now, it's good to have some defined pieces to the volunteer that they're asking you to do. So, I think if you can put some boundaries around it, say, okay, I'd like to be on that committee. What does that mean exactly? What is my time commitment? What are the outcome projects? What's the stop and end point? I think by having that conversation, I found that I'm able to get people engaged in a positive way that helps them to not be overcommitted. So I think if you control on that front end of making sure that that's defined, I think the generations before me, at least, were more inclined to just jump in and do it all. And I don't think I think that communication is important to make a decision about it. And the last thing I'd say is focus on your passion. So, if you get asked to do something, you're like, geez, I'm not really interested in that, but I really enjoy EMS and I want to do that. Then I would stick in with that thing that hits your passion. And sometimes you may think it's your passion and you get in there, you do the project, you finish it, you go, geez, I didn't like that. Well, try something else. I mean, that's the beauty of volunteering at the hospital level, volunteering national, state. You can kind of try different committees and find where your niche is.
Okay, so speaking as one of the boomers, thank you very much. You can't overcommit.
next question.
There we go. That being said, a little tongue-in-cheek, but young in your career, you should be committing. You should be committing to things that are new to you, that you are going to explore. Keeping in mind that I'm 100% behind the work-life balance, and making sure that you have time for your circadian rhythms, you have time for your personal life, you have time for your family. But that being said, there are a tremendous number of opportunities out there, and so you have to just sort of take the time to commit to them and, you know, basically be all in to really find out if that's going to be what you're going to be interested in. There are midlife career changes. I'm an example of that. I started out actually as a neuroscientist and spent the first almost 10 years of my career during basic neuroscience research dropping electrodes into rat brains. That's why I ended up at UIC, is because I had mentors there that I had found during residency that were going to allow me to pursue my research career. And so when that sort of took a left turn, that's when I sort of discovered education and sort of made education my passion. So again, you're in a 30-year commitment to emergency medicine, but you're not in a 30-year commitment to whatever you decide your niche is going to be. It is possible to change. It is possible to find other niches. But the only way that you're going to find those other niches is through making a commitment to do a project, to be on a committee, to do some type of other work.
One last comment I'd say is the finances are important too. So you got to make sure you're financially planning correctly, because if you have to work 200 hours a month to make ends meet, you're not going to be doing anything but working, which is not a fun life. So I think that financial piece is so crucial.
As well as the word passion can't be overstated enough. If you really love what you're doing, all the extra hours and that really seem to melt away. It's really not an issue. It's when you're doing something you just don't like doing. That's when getting through a day gets very difficult. So whatever you're saying yes to, and you're, whether it's overcommitting or not, it should be you're saying yes to something that you're passionate about, because you will also be the most successful in those areas.
You three are all in leadership roles, and could you maybe just from a practical standpoint say sort of the hats that you wear, and then also I'd be curious to know what clinical schedule that leaves you with. So what are sort of your major involved in administrative responsibilities, and then how does that translate to X number of shifts per month?
So on the career side, I'm executive vice president for the North Division of MCARE. So MCARE is divided regionally. So the North Division is basically the Midwest and the Northeast kind of put together. My boss is the regional CEO in emergency physician, and he's out of Philadelphia, Russ Harris. So between Russ and I, we sort of divide up the division, the region, into Midwest and Northeast. My role is really to, I do hands-on practice management, so I'm doing working with hospitals on goal setting and with our medical directors on goal setting, quality, program implementation, best practices, mentoring, professional development. I do some education. I do lecturing. I'm lecturing at our medical director conference in 2 weeks on how to be a medical director. Actually, I'm recruiting and team building. So that's an aspect. And then I do a lot of strategic planning for the division, which then feeds into our company. Of interest, just on a side note, is that as I was talking to somebody here today, we are doing other specialties now. So I'm starting to work with hospitalist groups, which has been a challenge outside the comfort zone, and been learning a lot about that as well. So I would say about 10% of my time is teaching, about 60% is administrative, and I work with all of our recruiting team credentialing, et cetera, on the process part. And about 30% of my time is clinical, split between two hospitals. And then on my other side, as ASEP Board of Directors member, we have 5 meetings a year, do a lot of board liaison work where I'm the board member responsible to interacting with different committees. I have a set of committees I'm responsible for and sections. And then go around, do lectures, do panels, do residency visits, and represent ASEP. I do radio interviews, et cetera, as an ASEP board member, and then represent you when we have our board meetings at the national level.
I'll talk about the funded hats that I wear.
Yeah, the last part was it's funded a little, but
yeah. So this is where the overcommitment comes in. So I get paid, so as, you know, as chairman, you guys understand chairman probably better than the rest of the world. But there, even amongst chairman, there are different things chairman do. So my job as chair is, I have oversight of the day-to-day operations, but I have great medical directors like Dr. Ward who do a lot of the heavy lifting, so I have oversight over that. The hospital pays me 70% of my salary to be chairman of the department. I also co-chair the Emergency Management Committee. I'm past chair of the Emergency Resuscitation Committee. I'm president-elect of our medical staff. That takes up most of my time. I'm funded by the Department of Defense. I have a $10 million multi-year grant to do research for Department of Defense. That's like another 25%. I'm running out of time here. That leaves me with about 5% for shifts. So I don't do many shifts. And I actually feel bad for my group when I do get back in the room, so thank you to Ed, to the group, for allowing me back in the room every now and then to see patients. The day when I do shifts, it's probably the easiest part of my job, to be honest with you, because it's a defined beginning and end, and I can go home and feel I've got something done. All the other stuff I just mentioned, it doesn't go away at the end of the day. It's there when I go home. I work on it at home, work on it on the weekends. The shifts are the best part.
Yeah, should I walk up to this mic?
I can repeat it
okay.
If you'd like.
I know you guys are talking about, you know, getting out there in the community, doing a good job, and these opportunities will come to you. Do you guys see that changing in the coming years, in the landscape of EA? You know, those with fellowships will kind of get those opportunities preferentially, or, you know, how should we be positioning ourselves as far as that's concerned? Or should we be thinking about that?
That's a good, so the question, if I can repeat it, I think is are some of these opportunities in the future going to be preferentially offered and maybe delivered to people with formal fellowship training?
Yeah. Okay. I'll take a stab at that one. To some extent, yes, but those are primarily going to be going to places that have educational programs, such as EM residencies and things like that. I think that when you start taking a look at just community hospitals, which make up at least 80%, if not more, I don't know if you know the numbers, of the total number of hospitals in the United States, they're basically community-based hospitals. And they're not necessarily going to need or want specialty training. What they're going to want, actually, is going to be people who are interested in administration. So, I mean, if you want to do, or if you can find a fellowship, and this would be a neat fellowship to try to do, is sort of the patient safety and QI fellowship, then you'd be invaluable. But they're not necessarily going to want the ultrasound fellow-trained person or the toxicology-trained person. Those are going to be much more of the academic institutions that will be looking for that.
Yeah, let me jump in there. I think what Brad said, I agree with what Brad said. You know, so here's what I see. When you look at what's coming with the Affordable Care Act and the rollout of what's happening, it's medical home network initiatives are really focusing more on things that like behavioral health and creating protocols. It's very administrative. I agree. I'm not sure some of the niche fellowship, the fellowships will be applicable at an academic center, not necessarily to the rest of the world. So what I've done is I've actually gone back to school at U of I to get an MPH degree in health policy and administration, because I think the way to affect change in our specialty is going to be through policy, and we're not trained in that. So that's not a fellowship. That's actually another degree. I guess that's another unfunded hat. That's, I'm putting money out for that one. Unless you can help me. But
come be faculty with me.
Maybe, so getting other degrees in public health, administration. What I plan to do with the MPH once I get it is I'm a member of the American College of Physician Executives. I'll be applying for my CP, which is Certified Physician Executive. I personally think that's what's going to make the biggest impact in healthcare moving forward, are those types of degrees.
I think moving forward, the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, there's going to be a couple of changes coming our way. There's going to be more payment based on the quality that you deliver, as Dino's talking about, and we're going to be thinking a lot about how does that look and how do we get reimbursed based on quality rather than just seeing patients one by one by one. The second thing is we're going to see a massive shift in payer mix. I think in emergency medicine we'll be okay, but we may not. We're not sure what's going to happen there, but as the exchanges come up, There are gonna be commercial insurers that are gonna dump their patients into the exchanges, I think. And in the states that don't expand Medicaid, Illinois is expanding Medicaid, but Texas is not, for example, that's gonna be really tough, is that, because those commercial payers balance out the self-pay in the Medicaid population. If all those folks go on Medicaid and get out of exchanges, we'll probably be okay as a specialty. Our other specialties, though, may not. And that will affect us as well, because people may not have access to care. We already see that in Illinois with our folks that have Medicaid, they don't have anywhere to go. So I think that if we can come out of this in 5 to 10 years earning the same salary we earn now, that will be a win. And that actually is something that we're working very hard on, approaching on the advocacy side within the college itself. Looking in terms of your career path and doing fellowships or not from private practice, I would tell you most of us in this that are doing this type of work, we learned it just by having that mentor, by being on those ASEP committees, by jumping in on that project and actually doing a QA project and learning how that works. So there are administrative fellowship programs out there. There's some academic based, some of the private groups have their own, and those are great, but you can get there without doing those programs as well.
So just as sort of a side note, getting back to sort of putting yourself out there and volunteering for things. So I've had the pleasure of lecturing at Scientific Assembly for the last several years. And I got asked back, and I normally do neurological stuff, particularly stroke stuff. And they said, well, we would love to have you come back, but we need you to do a whole new talk. And I was like, oh, right, what? I said, headache. Really? Can I do subarachnoid? No. So I got stuck with migraines and cluster headaches, and I'm now putting together my talk on this. But what's interesting is as you finally become the active learner, the adult learner that we need to do, and you start looking at PubMed articles and all that kind of stuff, it segues into what Becky was just talking about. So I found this article about how CMS is going to be labeling some of the things that we do as, quote, inappropriate. And when they label something as inappropriate, that means no reimbursement. So there's a whole article on how CMS is going to start labeling CAT scans of headaches as inappropriate, and how that is going to affect your reimbursement. Now, I'm not asking any of you to write my lecture on headaches, but it's one of those things that when you start getting active in some of these volunteer things that you're going to be asked to do, you're going to find other pieces buried in there that are also going to be things that you're going to be interested in.
Oh, one last comment I would say. I think part of your question was, are these jobs going to be there for, you know, as folks are coming out? I would tell you, we're all succession planning right now. I mean, ASAP, that's all we're talking about. ISAP, talking about who's going to be coming up the pipeline to take over these roles as people start exiting out. And so I think there's tons of opportunity to start getting in here, start getting the knowledge you need to get those mentors lined up. And in 10 to 15 years, you guys are going to be sitting here talking to that next generation. So, you know, there's definitely opportunity there. Absolutely.
Yeah, I might ask you all to expand a little bit on the things that I think we just touched a little bit on the ACA, and not completely derailing the topic of the panel, but as you all are so heavily involved, you probably are uniquely qualified to speak on it. And obviously, like, outside of, you know, being able to intubate somebody and deal with a sick kid, like, what do you think are going to be the characteristics that, like, we need to have to be successful in this brave new world? I mean, understanding that we don't, the new characteristics, besides just being nice people and being able to see patients relatively quickly.
One of the interesting pieces that's going to come out of this, and it's probably not going to be for another 5 years or more, is going to be the concept of just being the conservative doc and ordering everything is going to go by the wayside, or you're going to take a hit in your salary. There is going to be a lot more of this sort of ACA, CMS-driven protocolization of various diagnoses, how you work up a PE, how you work up the chest pain that you're going to try to define as the PE, how you're going to work up the headache, as I mentioned before. So I think a lot of this is going to change the way in which we practice and ultimately the way in which we get paid.
It's going to, also the way it's rolling out, you know, if you notice, nobody took EMTALA away from us, nor should they. EMTALA was a great law. Other than it's unfunded. but I'm finding we're gonna, I think we're gonna struggle with the, what EMTALA says we have to do to provide, you know, medical screening, exam, and stabilization. And then we're also gonna be challenged with people calling. Actually, it's happening right now. Medical home network administrators calling the ER, asking to speak with the patient, saying, what are you doing in that ER? It's happening right now. And so we're gonna be struggling with trying to satisfy EMTALA criteria, stabilize patients, screen them, and then we're gonna be moving them out. So I've always said that, you know, a good emergency physician is about a third clinician, a third policeman, and a third social worker. I see the social worker piece picking up a bit here. You know, we're gonna be doing a lot of just bedside, sitting with patients, working with administrators, and trying to get patients back into the proper medical home network.
A couple thoughts. One is on the reimbursement. I agree with what both my colleagues said. One is on the reimbursement side. Get to know those quality measures as they come out. You know, your groups will be telling you, hey, we need you to pay attention to this quality measure now. We need you to pay attention to your RVUs. They'll guide you because they'll be trying to capture as much revenue as possible. It is shifting to more of those quality aspects. That's one. Two, I completely agree on the coordination of care. And I think one of the things that we need to do as a specialty is kind of broaden our minds into what our role is, because we need to see this coordination of care as an opportunity and not a burden. And don't get me wrong, we need to get paid for coordinating care and being sure that, you know, if we're doing some of those conversations or running an observation unit, we should be sure that we're getting reimbursed for that. But we're gonna need to be outside of our comfort zone as a specialty and start thinking about, hey, emergency medicine, this is an opportunity. We're the best people to know where the patient belongs. I mean, that's why they send them to us, right? Like, I don't know if this person should be admitted or not. We're the diagnosticians, and we're gonna be asked more and more to figure out, you know, do they need to be in obs care for a little bit? Can they go to SNF? Can they go to the palliative care floor, et cetera? And I think we'll need to embrace those new roles, and we might be creating some new curriculum with the help of these gentlemen to my right to teach ourselves and then our residents coming up. But I think that's gonna be a change for us.
So the good news is that you're gonna have job security.
Yes.
Okay, you're absolutely positively gonna have job security. The question is gonna be how much you're gonna get paid for it. I believe, and this is just my own personal thought, that implementation of things in the ACA and things like that are going to take at least three generations of Americans to be implemented. Because Americans like us. They like the 24/7 service, they like being able to come to us, and quite frankly, our colleagues in the other specialties like having us available as well. So you're going to have a hard time convincing a lot of families and a lot of people that the emergency department is not the best place to go for their care, because it's what they've done for generations so far. That being said, we're gonna have to be a whole lot more responsible for the resources that we utilize.
I just wanna add to that. I haven't figured this piece out yet, but here's what we know. We know that the primary care infrastructure is not ready to support what has been already mandated. And when you look at how many times we get patients in the ER sent by a primary care provider who thought it was an emergency, but it wasn't. And then we're, like I just said, we're mandated to get them back into the community. It almost seems like you need more emergency physicians, and maybe not just emergency department-based physicians. I don't know if that's hypocritical or not, but we need this training that we get is the right training for where they want the future of healthcare to go to. We have to think out of the box yet, and I haven't formulated this idea fully, but you know, we think of ourselves as hospital-based. We work in the box in the emergency department down at the ground level of the hospital. I think somehow we have to push the initiative. We actually belong outside of that box as well. You know, I think we can better manage a lot of these patients in the outpatient setting than our primary care colleagues can.
As a matter of fact, a number of you will probably never work in a hospital. A number of you may go to work in freestanding emergency departments because those are actually popping up and becoming very popular as entryways into other health systems. And so as that continues to grow, that's going to be more of the opportunity that emergency physicians are going to have.
Again, by the way, popped up in the 80s, and then it's back again.
And one last thing to think about too, first of all, our patients are sicker and sicker. Gone are the days where I've seen 10 sore throats and 2 chest pains. I mean, it's almost everybody's sick. And then the last thing is that our workforce, what that looks like, is gonna be evolving to meet the needs We're going to be using PAs and MPs more and more. We're going to have scribes to help us get our paperwork done. And we've got to figure out how we want that to look as a specialty so that we use them appropriately. But that we're going to need those ancillary folks to help us in the future.
It's a great discussion. If you guys have just really anything else brief in closing, we could probably wrap up and we're right on schedule.
Laura said I can.
Oh, okay.